everybody to Breaking Kayfabe. I am your host, Jeff Bowden. With me, my co-host from the mean streets of Ambler, PA, and he lives on the last house on the left. It's my man, Barry Rose. Barry, how are you doing tonight?
I am rocking and rolling in Ambler. Doing great, Jeff. Super excited for this week's episode. It feels like we haven't recorded in a long time, but it really hasn't been so long. I just think so much has happened. My kid went off to college, and I spent some time there. You've been up house hunting, and congratulations, Jeff, because the dream house in Georgia apparently is yours.
Well, that's the rumor. We are moving to the greater Cumming, Georgia area. No jokes there, Barry. And we are actually recording this a little bit out of schedule because we've got more plans to go back up there. The wife has to do all this. Thank you, Molly, for shaking on the air. More plans to do the administrative task before she starts her job. So we're going to be going up there. Everyone say hello to Molly here on National Dog Day as we record, Barry. So shout out to Ozzy from my girl Molly. But yeah, we're very excited about that. And we really, I think, lucked into a very, very nice house. And it's just amazing. We'll get into the details of that towards the end of the show, Barry, because what I want to talk about today, folks, is we don't just break kayfabe on houses in Georgia. We break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, pop culture, wrestling. And today is a heavy focus on wrestling, Barry. I know you and I are very excited about today's topic because we're going to delve into one of wrestling's dark little secrets as we are going to be discussing blading and blood matches and all that kind of shit. And I know folks are going to be super, super stoked to listen to this because joining us, special guest appearance. I have put out the call to Lightning with the dog whistle, and Lightning has settled up the Tennessee Stud. Ron Fuller going to join us today on this special episode, Barry.
And I'll tell you what's great about that, Jeff. I do have a couple of rituals on the day that we record. And I normally, if we're going to be recording, I grab my Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry shirt. Jeff, how many of those shirts are left, by the way?
Right now, we stand at a grand total of zero. I'm sure everyone out there in the listening audience and on our Facebook group has one of the shirts. But, so you grab the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry t-shirt and?
And I put it back in the drawer. And I broke out my Studcast shirt, which is a fantastic shirt. And I'm wearing that today in honor of Ron making his second appearance on Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry. So pretty excited because I'll tell you, if there's anybody that is going to know about blading, blood, and the impact of blood on a professional wrestling card, it's going to be somebody that ran his own promotion in the Deep South in the 1970s. And the Tennessee Stud obviously fits that bill to a T.
Well, and the only one that truly knows if you wearing that stud cast means anything is, of course, the lovely Mrs. Rose. So besides all that, we are also going to be taking a look. You know, Barry, for years now, there has been a term used when, I guess, setting the standard and the scale for a blood match in professional wrestling. Barry, that is called the Muda Scale. And the Muda Scale was first established after a match in Japan between the Great Muda and Hiroshi Hase that took place on December 14th, 1992. Let's just say that the Great Muda hit a gusher. And we're going to be talking about that match today, as well as some other stuff involving blood in matches, what works, what doesn't, when it works, when it doesn't. And I think we're going to have a good time talking about this, Barry.
I think we already are, Jeff. I think we're there. We're already having fun. And it's a great topic, too. You know, the concept of blood in wrestling is, when you look at it now, it's foreign on so many different levels because a lot of today's generation really doesn't see blood in matches unless they're watching like CZW or the IWA, the stuff that I'm not a huge fan of, which is, you know, primarily the gimmick. You know, that kind of shit, which is all geared towards extreme violence and blood. But, you know, the mainstream, WWE doesn't do blood. I think ROH does it on occasion. I know that I've seen a couple of matches with ROH. AEW obviously had that bloodbath with the Rhodes brothers where they faced off with each other. Japan still does it. But, you know, back in the day when you and I had hair and were thinner, Jeff, blood was on every fucking card in Florida. There wasn't, you know, if you went to a night's matches in Miami Beach and somebody wasn't bleeding, it was incomplete. And it was the norm. You know, I look back at it now and I'm like, it's kind of fucking, you know, sick in a way, you know, that guys were taking the blade and they were cutting their foreheads. It's, you know, when you step outside and you look at it, it's very odd. But at the same time, it's what we grew up with. It was the norm. It was what was expected back in the day. So we are, Jeff, we are going to talk about some of the great blood matches that we've seen and some of the great blood matches that are out there. And we're going to talk about some of the great bladers of all time as well.
Yeah. And, you know, let me just clarify for the purpose of this show. When you talked about different sort of promotions that specialize in this kind of thing. We're not going to be talking about the gangsters and mass transit on this show. I'm talking about legitimate matches. Here's the scale I'm looking at, Barry. We're talking about a match from a mainstream promotion where blood was involved, and it got to the point where the blood kind of made you go, ooh, my, that's a little bit much. And just like you referenced the Dustin versus Cody match, where Dustin just hit a freaking gusher, and it got to the point where you're kind of like going, you know, wow, that's more than I normally see, you know. And we're going to talk about when blood, you know, when it's effective in a match. And in that match, it was very effective. You know, I don't know if they needed necessarily that much, but, you know, we've all seen the matches out there. You can go and Google or YouTube the 10 bloodiest matches, and you can see one of these freak show matches where they use a, you know, hit somebody over the head with a light bulb, for God's sake, or they take a dive off a balcony or something really stupid like that. I'm talking about a match that took place, let's just say NWA match, a WWF match, a Japanese match, one of the territory matches, you know, not the match that took place down at the Elks Club, you know, in front of 50 people. That to me is not being talked about. And, you know, I consider the mass transit a gangsters match. That is not something that I think is part of this discussion, because quite frankly, I don't think that was a match. I think that was basically a borderline assault, but I won't get into that.
When you say borderline,
I was being extremely nice.
Okay. I was going to say, so you know, I've seen the mass transit thing, and I've seen, and we should say too that the Eric Kulas, which I believe was his name, he has since passed away. I believe he passed away 5, 6, 7 years ago. I think it was complications or something during weight loss surgery. But this was essentially a young kid that was put into a match with New Jack, who has a reputation which he may not have been aware of, and they bladed this kid to the point that he looked like he was dying. And this kid's father was in the arena, and apparently I think I heard that he disrespected New Jack or something like that. But when you see this, you just say, oh my God. What's worse about that is when you hear people defend it, Jeff. And I have seen people online in various groups defend this. Again, this was a kid. Was he 18, 17, 19?
No, I think I know he might have been young. Like 16.
That's, he was, you know, really young. And
he's just a big
literally,
kid.
He was a kid, and, you know, I've seen this. I've seen it a couple. There's a few of these videos, and when we say garbage promotions, there is the promotion IWA where they beat up this guy. And he's bloody, but it's what they do to him. And it just, for the life of me, I can't see how anybody would enjoy watching something. It's like literally just watching one person try to kill another. And, you know, wrestling, I think part of the whole thing with wrestling and the psychology of it is we're well aware that this is a work. You know, we're not watching people legitimately trying to kill each other. I just, something about it just was so wrong. And again, this kid has since passed on, which is, you know, it's a shame because he was a young guy. But no, I'm with you on that, Jeff. I think to qualify, I think it shouldn't be a promotion that's just based out of blood. It should be where blood, to me, you know, the blood was something that was used to really sell the point. So, you know, I grew up watching Dusty Rhodes, and I saw Dusty wrestle, in person hundreds of times, Jeff. I can't even count the amount. And I would say the majority of those matches included blood. I would, you know, if I was maybe 75 or 80%, it was a known fact. Dusty bled every Wednesday night in Miami Beach, as he did in every Tuesday in Tampa. And it became to the point where you know, it was almost like, I remember saying this as I got older too, how long until Dusty bleeds? And there was a match one night against the Sheik, and we basically said, and I may have said it to the professor, Peter Lederberg, I said, how long do you think until Dusty actually bleeds? And I'm not making this up. As Dusty was coming to the ring, the Sheik jumped out of the ring, and Dusty never made it in the ring and was already bloody by the time he did make it in the ring. That's how quickly it happened. But, you know, blood was used as an exclamation point. It was a selling point. And really, in theory, and I reached out to a couple of people to get their thoughts on blood and blading. And from the intelligent perspective, which nobody has ever accused us of, Jeff, but from an intelligent perspective, the idea of blood in a match should be really to advance ticket sales for the return match next week. And that makes a lot of sense to me. You know, two guys go at it. They're beating the shit out of each other. One guy's bloody. The other guy wants to get his revenge, whatever it is. Here's the rematch next week. That seems to make a lot of sense to me. But there are certain promotions, and again, we're not going to focus on that, where there's blood in every match. And to me, it's completely lost when something like that happens.
Well, you know, one of the things that, as I was doing my own bit of research here, is I recall, I don't know if it was Starrcade, either it was 84 or 85, where I think like maybe second match on the card, there was blood. There was blood like on the fourth and fifth match. It was like out of a 9-match card, there was blood in like 7 of the matches. And it's just, you know, it's that point where it starts getting a little ridiculous. And, you know, quite frankly, it doesn't mean anything after that. You know, you're absolutely right. It should be something that brings the fans back the next week, or it should be an angle that's on TV that sets up something that causes people to want to come to the building or to watch the match on TV or to see it on, you know, pay-per-view. I know that's kind of an archaic term at this point, or to stream the match, if you will, whatever, to cause people to want to watch the program. And if you're just doing it for the, you know, that's what the freak shows do. The guys using the light bulbs and the tacks on the ground and stuff like that. They're just, you know, they might as well just go out there, hold up the blade and start sawing their head, because, you know, that's all it means. And, you know, one of the things I always found funny, I don't know if it was in his book or not, but Bobby Heenan had a famous quote where he was doing a match or something, and Wally Carbo was right there, and he said, "It's time to whack, Wally." And, you know, it went, and, you know, when you know how to use it so that it sells tickets or it causes tickets for a future match to be sold, it can be very effective. You know, when it gets watered down, I mean, think about like in the mid 80s, when San Antonio had lost the USA cable spot and John Boyd came in there and became the booker. There was like blood in every single match they had. It was called a blood promotion because John Boyd was, and maybe he was just throwing shit against the wall, seeing what stuck. And so he was trying anything, but it was literally where you would have blood in every match. So guess what? It doesn't mean anything, you know?
Didn't Boyd essentially kill the promotion, though?
Pretty much, yeah. And, you know, so when you had a blood match, that's why, you know, one of the matches that when I was talking about, we're talking about famous blood matches. One of the ones as I was going down trying to figure out, you know, there's a couple of them that we have mentioned already on this show in previous episodes. And one of them was the Terry Gordy versus Killer Khan match in World Class. World Class never did blood. You know, the Von Erich boys were never involved in any kind of blood matches. And so here, when this match happened, part of the reason it made such an impact was because they never did it, you know. And when you never do that and, you have a match like that, it really creates an impact and it really makes things memorable, you know. And I think it just point, you're exactly right. The promotion ended up falling under, and maybe was that the reason, or was it, you know, other factors? I'm sure there were other factors, but, you know, that became known as a blood promotion. So
yeah, but that's the way to kill a territory too.
And sure.
So, you know, there was a group of guys in the mid 1970s that followed each other from territory to territory. And it was Mark Lewin, King Curtis, and Big Bad John. And there were some other guys mixed in with it. And they were known for that. And they had had success in Australia. I believe they did a lot of damage to Australia by the end based off of that. I want to say they spent time in Calgary, which was short-lived, but they actually brought that down to Florida as well.
Yeah.
And it was Mark Lewin was booking, and this was after Harley Race, and his booking was he brought in King Curtis, he brought in Big Bad John, and it didn't really work out. So, it was very, very difficult, I think, to re-educate fans that, oh, this is the way things are going to be now. And again, in Florida, we were used to blood, but now you've got blood in the second match of the night, in the third match of the night, much as Jonathan Boyd did. And that right there, people aren't really going to go for it. You know, when it becomes a blood promotion, I guess you're going to have some people embrace it. But for the most part, you're taking away the emphasis of the Heat. You know, it's kind of like the Sheik, and the Sheik obviously built his entire career. Guys like the Sheik and Abdullah built their entire careers out of blood. They did, you know, and guys like Dusty, King Curtis, Joe LaDuke, there were some great bladers, but you know, you take away the Sheik and his pencil and bleeding, and what were you really left with? And certainly, you know, Detroit was running the ground. Toronto also, I mean, how many sellouts did he have in Toronto? He was the hottest thing ever. And then it ended, you know, and I've heard various stories on why it ended. And I can't put all the emphasis on overuse of the blade, but I think, you know, it was so important, but there were some guys that were just so addicted to it that it takes away any sort of meaning at all. And you know, I reached out to George Shire, and you're familiar with George Shire, Jeff?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, George has been on the 605 with Brian a couple of times, and George said something years back, and I guess maybe I misinterpreted, but I knew that he wasn't a fan of blood, and I think I posted photos, or maybe the professor did, and George made a comment about how, you know, this is disgusting, it's not really wrestling. So I reached out to him, and I was like, George, do I remember this correctly, that you don't like blood in matches? And he responded, and he said, it wasn't that I didn't like blood matches, but rather how often some territories and wrestlers use them. I always understood why red was good, but always felt that guys like the Sheik and Abdullah the Butcher overdid them. And he's right about that. And I could say the same for Dusty and Bruiser Brody as well. Every match for me was overkill. The Crusher used to bleed, but it was usually either at the start or the finish of a program with an opponent. And for the life of me, I never understood how some fans could take a steady diet of blood on every card. Of course, all just my own opinion, but a lot of that, what he's saying, I actually agree with.
Yeah. And, you know, you attract a different kind of crowd too. You know, you're not going to get parents bringing their kids to matches if there's blood in the second, third, fourth, and fifth match, you know, I mean, because right. at some point the parent, you know, whether, you know, back in the day, there was always like, oh, it's fake blood. And you know, that every kind of different excuse, but you know, the violence is kicked up a notch with all that blood. And it's something that, you know, then you start attracting guys that are maybe coming in from the bar and they've thrown a few back. And so they're going to get a little bit rowdy. So now you've got a rowdier crowd to deal with too. And so listen, before we go too much further, let's get to our match of the week that we're going to discuss. And as I said, folks, we're talking about the match that set the standard for the blood match. And that's the match between the Great Muta and Hiroshi Hase, December 14th, 1992, New Japan Wrestling. Barry, you had a chance to watch this match this week. Tell us what you thought of it.
Yeah, so I had seen this match, but I don't think I had seen it probably since within a month of it when it aired, when I was getting tapes from one of my various dealers. Because back in those days, Jeff, getting Japanese tapes in the early 90s was the greatest gift you could get when you'd walk out to the mailbox and there was a tape or two and you were like, shit, I can't wait. It's All Japan or New Japan or, you know, or FMW or something like that. So I guess I haven't seen this in probably 27 years, something like that. But I rewatched the match and I, you know, it's, if you want to see a lot of blood, it's a great match. You know, other than that, it's not really the greatest match because the emphasis truly was on the heat between the two and the blood. And it's kind of a shame because Hiroshi Hase really undervalued in the history of professional wrestling. This guy was great. You know, I remember his the tag team he had. What was his partner's name?
The Viet Cong Express with Fumihiro.
In Japan,
Nakura.
The guy that's married to Akira Fukuto, isn't it?
Oh, Hashimoto. Was it Hashimoto?
Hashimoto's dead. The squat guy.
I'm sorry. Kensuke Sasaki.
Sasaki, right, exactly. So they were such a good team back then. This is what happens when you hit 52, Jeff. You're like, what is the fucking guy's name, right? You know, I've only seen 8,000
of his
matches.
You talk about a dead guy.
Yeah, they're a dead guy, exactly. What, you know, this is what you all have to look forward to as you get older. But Hase was so great, and I believe he's a politician in Japan now. And he always seemed, you know, I guess a step above from an intelligence standpoint. But yeah, I was such a fan of him. This unfortunately is not a great showcase of what he can do. However, if you want to see a literal fucking bloodbath, this is the match. And Muda goes under the ring and he grabs what looks to be a spike. And I think it might be the thing that they turn the ring ropes with when they put it and they turn the ring ropes. I'm not sure, but that's what it looks like. Hase gets it away from him and spikes Muda in the head. And immediately the blood flows. And there's a close up of Muda right after, and the blood is just, it's like a, I don't want to say a waterfall, but somebody has turned on the spigot, and the blood is just seeping out of his head, it's pooling up on the mat, and he's covered within a minute or so. I mean, he's just completely covered. And the rest of the match, it's very dramatic, because it's all over Hase, but there's a moment in this match where Hase gets Muda in a sleeper and he's squeezing him. It's fucking disgusting. As he's squeezing him, the blood is just, you know, and I really do think he's squeezing him on purpose to make the blood come out. Not that he needed any help, Muda, but it's just, as you watch this, it's disgusting. But I gotta say, Jeff, is it an accurate term to call it the Muda scale? Have there been bloodier matches? Because one came to mind, and I'm talking more of a more recent match. So, you know, a match within the last 10 or 20 years as opposed to a memory I've got from 40 years ago. But, you know, I didn't love this match. If you do love this match, you're probably a fucking psychopath. But and I mean that in the nicest way when I say that. But you know, it's not a great match. But if you are really heavily into blood and professional wrestling, then you probably have already seen this. I'm sure we're not breaking new ground with this because it is a fucking bloodbath.
Well, here's the thing. The thing about this match that is, to me, kind of interesting, kind of different is, you know, when we talked about matches with Abdullah the Butcher and the Sheik and stuff like that, who, credit where it's due, were tremendous attractions for any promotion having the card. But, of course, you knew what you were going to get. You know, Abdullah the Butcher and the Sheik weren't going to go out and wrestle a 45-minute Broadway or something like that with lots of technical Carl Gotch-like holds. You know, they were what they were. Now, your great Muda and Hiro Hase, completely capable of having that very match. They could have brought the house down because both guys were absolutely amazing at this point in their career. So the fact that you take two incredible wrestlers like that and you put them in this kind of match is really, and of course, you know, Keiji Muto under the guise of the great Muda. And that's really that could be a case study for one episode, Barry, is how the guy is over as Keiji Muto. But then he has this character that he sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, he becomes this character of the great Muda, which is like this dark side of Keiji Muto. And both the guy and his character are incredibly over. And, you know, when he becomes the character, it's just like the crowd, they know it's Keiji Muto, but they also understand, oh, now he's become the character. It's like really, I don't know. It's just really kind of interesting to watch that happen. But so they have this match. And I want to say it's around the 12 or 13 minute point in the match when Hasi hits Muta with the spike that Muta brought in the ring, and you're right, the river starts a flowing, and you know, it's well, let's just say it's averaged a good match. But you know, I recall many episodes ago, Barry, we talked about the Chigusa versus Dump Matsumoto match and how the whole appeal of the match wasn't necessarily that it was technically great, but it was the spectacle that you were watching. And this is what is compelling to me about this match. It's the spectacle, not because there's blood in the match, but how much blood there is in the match. And the fact that it's almost like, you know, oh my God, let me just put out for our boy Benji. Don't let Antonio watch this match with you, because it will probably severely alter the way that Antonio ever looks at a wrestling match again. So, you know, but this is a match that I think is kind of compelling to watch just because it's like the standard bearer. Now, that being said, you know, you said, is this the bloodiest match in the history of wrestling? No. Like I said, there's garbage matches that I'm sure involve more blood. You know, again, let's quantify. We're talking not about a match where a guy looks like he hit a gush or something like that. I'm talking about where you see a guy and you see the blood coagulating on his head and it starts literally flowing out of his head, or the guy is leaning over the mat and you see it pouring onto the mat. We've seen that. So I started coming up. And I came up with a list of a few matches that I felt could have qualified for these, Barry. And I'm going to guess that you've seen the majority of these matches. So let me just point out the matches that I thought of. You tell me whether or not the match that you thought topped the Muta scale is on this list, okay? Okay, we're going to talk about Chris Jericho and Lance Storm versus the Heavenly Bodies from Smoky Mountain, August 5th, 1994. Is that it?
That isn't the match, but holy shit, that's a fucking bloodbath as well.
Yep, you're right. And just recently discussed on both Chris Jericho's podcast and Jim Cornette's podcast. So give those a listen. And I had a chance to watch it, and yeah, it's pretty out there. So I reached out to a couple of people also. What's your bloodiest match you've ever seen live or on television? We asked our good friend Jamie Ward. Jamie recalled a night in late 1985 in Philadelphia when Magnum TA was facing Ric Flair. Magnum goes down, begins to get the gig. And Jamie apparently makes some smart alecky comment to Magnum mid-gig. Magnum steps up, shakes his head, and gets blood all over Jamie's shoes, which I think is pretty hilarious, and says, "Fuck you, jerk off," which I thought was pretty funny. So then Eric Chulminski mentions a match involving the aforementioned Kintsuki Sasaki versus Yuji Nagata. Interesting backstory to this match. Sasaki had left New Japan, had gone to work with Riki Choshu, who was starting to try up a new promotion. So he was brought back and was sort of regarded by the New Japan fans as a heel because he had left the promotion. And the quote that Eric gave me was, "There was a sickening amount of blood in this match." So that's one to look up. Then we got the Pat Patterson, Sergeant Slaughter, which we've talked about on this show, the one from Madison Square Garden. Ted DiBiase versus Ric Flair, the Mid-South episode, one of the greatest angles of all time. We've talked about that before. Here's one, Barry, you may not have seen, but if you go to Google and type this in, Akira Hokuta versus, I want to say her name, is Shinobu Kandori from April 2nd, 1993 at Dream Slam. Hokuta just bleeds like, oh my God, it's just terrible. Luke Kippelman offering up a couple choices. The Rockers versus Buddy Rose and Doug Summers from AWA Television. September 2nd, 1986, Terry Gordy versus Killer Khan. We talked about that, November of 1984. Jimmy Snuka versus Larry Zbyszko. Not so much because of the match, Lou points out, but they did an angle involving Colonel DeBeers pile-driving Jimmy Snuka on the floor during the match. Larry Nelson with a great call over the house mic. "We need paramedics at ringside. We need paramedics immediately at ringside," as they're putting the neck brace on the Superfly. So then there's one last one that I'll mention, and I'm wondering, Barry, if this isn't in fact the one that you were referring to. We are talking February 16th. 2004 in Los Angeles, Eddie Guerrero versus JBL. Was that it?
Yeah, that's it. So it's that's a holy shit, and I don't know that there was more blood, though there possibly may have been, than Muta, but for whatever reason, it just seemed it had a greater impact. And they also, I want to say, they played to the blood a little bit more. Plus, it was shocking. It wasn't like you know, like a fucking attempted murder on WWE TV. or WWF at that point, whatever it was. So that is that. I would put that slightly above Muda, but certainly close, without a doubt, with that. All good choices, too. The Midnight Rockers match that Sweet Lou Kippelman mentioned also, that's a great match. And that's what I like to see, too. I don't just want to see a bloodbath. The blood is great if there's something else mixed in with it. If there's an actual wrestling match taking place, that's great. The thing with the Sheik for me, and look, some people fucking love the Sheik and Abdullah. On a daily basis, I'm interacting with people who are like, oh, the Sheik and Abdullah were the reasons I got into wrestling and whatever it is. But that's kind of what you got. You know, it wasn't like you were getting much else. The Sheik would come out with the pencil. You know, he would do his shtick. It was a 7-minute match. There was blood. But that was it. You know, it's to me, the drama is a guy like Terry Funk that would go out and have maybe a 20 or 25 minute match. And then there's blood involved because it's heightened. It heightens the match to me. So those were all excellent choices. That JBL Eddie Guerrero match, holy shit, Jeff. You've seen that one?
Yeah, no, I got a chance to look at it the other day.
So I'm going to pull up one that that no one's mentioned thus far, and it's Bill Alfonso against Beulah.
Yeah, that's absolutely one.
Oh, it's fucking, it's uncomfortable to watch it, and you know, you and I have seen Bill enough in person, we've never asked him about that, and I think if we see him at the next and cheap plug coming up, by the way, if we see him at the next CWF Legends Fan Fest, which is taking place on November the 9th in Lutz, Florida, headline with the Wyndham brothers, Barry and Kendall. But Bill always shows up, which is great. Bill's always there. We should absolutely ask him about that. And if I'm correct, Jeff, wasn't that Paulie's retribution for Bill trying to go to WCW?
That's a very good possibility. I'm not sure about that. I don't want to say because I'm really not sure about that. I mean, ECW had blood matches. Okay, let's be honest.
And, oh, absolutely.
You know, but they also featured the stuff with Eddie and Benoit and Jericho even and Dean Malenko. So it wasn't like every match was a blood circus. They had blood. You know, there were guys that, you know, I felt like Sandman. How many times could you watch a Sandman match? And, oh, my God, here's another bloodbath of a Sandman. It got to be a little repetitive, you know. And
that's
what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Sweet Lou, was I correct with, just in case you do know or don't know, with Bill Alfonso, wasn't he trying to either get in WCW or did, and he was out, and then he wanted to come back to ECW, and this was kind of the punishment to have him do this massive blade job for Beulah McGillicuddy?
Unfortunately, that would be the first I've heard of it. So, you know,
gotcha.
Maybe Barry is breaking kayfabe with you and
I. Yeah, we'll just go ahead and run with that one. You know, we need to get Bill on the phone and see what Bill says. But I want to say that I've either read or heard that story more than once. And my God, that was another uncomfortable match to watch.
So, you know, let's talk about another territory. When I first started getting into the After magazines, which I know Bill After hates for us to call him that, but that's really what everyone calls him. There was a point in time where, of course, he had blood featured literally every single month on one of the covers. And there was a big article that I remember, this is like 73, 74, 75-ish around there, where there was an article about how much blood was going on in Montreal. And the cover very famously had a picture of Joe LeDuc with the blood. You could see it flowing in a Muda / Eddie Guerrero, you know, and they talked about, you know, of course, it was the article was complete fiction, which Bill made up. But, you know, they had all these pictures of these guys that were working Montreal and all the matches. And so you know, it's not a thing that every territory uses, every territory doesn't, you know, it sort of depends, you know, Memphis, good Lord, Memphis knew how to use a good blood match. And it's the ones that don't know or do it to excess or the ones that never use it. And then when they do, it really means something. And that's what we're, you know, looking for. And I'm looking for the ones that are, you know, like I said, really kind of over the top and out of bounds. And so, you know what, Barry, I think at this point, what we should do, we should bring somebody in.
We should. I just wanted to touch base on one thing that you said. So I actually reached out to Bill After today Bill Apter is
name dropper.
Name dropper. He is my neighbor. He lives literally within 6 minutes of my house. So I reached out to him to get his thoughts on blood, and he was pretty short, but he goes, "I don't like it. I never liked it." He goes, "I can elaborate later tonight." And I was like, "Well, shit, Bill, we got to record." So I won't be able to get that. But he wasn't a fan. I know the photo of Joe LeDuc that you're talking about. It's where he's wincing. Is that the one?
Yeah, it's like someone has a nerve hold on him or something like that. But
yeah,
the blood
exactly. So I think what happened, if I'm correct, if you look at after when the magazines became after magazines, there was less blood. And I think when Stanley Weston had full control before Bill, because Bill kind of had that rise like in the mid-70s is where he kind of really took over, there was less blood. But prior to that, it does seem like a lot of the magazines were actually focusing on blood, especially on the covers. You mentioned Bobby Heenan earlier, and there was a cover, and Heenan's wearing a singlet, and I think he's like lying down or something, but it's like somebody's just gone up and just fucking, you know, drenched him in a bucket of blood. But that was almost the norm in the early 70s with the magazines, and no doubt it was intentional to try to sell those magazines.
Yeah, I mean, and again, you were trying. It was something that appealed to magazine readers at that point, and then at some point, it stopped appealing to magazine readers. You know, and I'm sure not just the magazine readers, but I'm sure the stores that carried the magazines. You know, if you're doing a mom and pop drugstore and you've got some photo of a guy absolutely bleeding all over himself, do you want to put that up next to your counter where people are coming in to buy candy and other things?
And you know, it's funny about that too. Like they probably had a policy, no Beaver magazines, you know, can't have like, you know, big titty magazines, but you could have essentially these guys just covered in blood. But yeah, that's a good point. I never really thought of that. You've got mom and pop who are 75 years old.
I'm sure Beaver magazine, Barry. Let's break
it. Every issue. Oh yeah, yeah. Every issue of Beaver.
What was your favorite? Swank. Let's see. All the really high class.
Oh, yes. I'm going to break kayfabe on this one because this was this was a moment when my wife and I we had just started dating. So this is probably early 1995. So right now everybody's, you know, the majority of our listeners were going, fuck, I was in second grade. In 1995, my wife and I had just started dating, and we were taking the subway somewhere. And Jeff, have you ever been in a New York subway, system?
I have.
Okay, so, you know, they have newsstands and all throughout the subways. And there was a newsstand, and my wife said, I need to get like a bottle of water. I forget what she was getting. So we walked over, and there was a guy there that was buying a magazine, and he's pointing. So they had the magazines are behind the owner, whatever, the guy who sells the shit, and you have to point instead of picking up as you would, say, in a normal newsstand. So he's pointing, and he goes, I'm going to take that one right there. And he was pointing to big-titted shaved Asians, which I just – I never got over that. I always thought that was just the absolute funniest thing. And my wife and I probably for like the next, you know, month would just make jokes about that magazine. So, yeah.
Give me a copy of Ass Play magazine there, guy. So that just reminds me one of the greatest movie scenes ever. Is you've seen the movie Summer of 42?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
When the kid goes into the drugstore to buy the condoms and he has no idea what he's doing, and he tells the guy, I'm going to need 3 dozen. The guy goes, you got a big night planned, have you? So anyway, now that we're done talking about swank and high society and Beaver magazine and all high class publications, it's a perfect segue. Now, why don't we go talk? Because as Barry said, if there's anybody that can provide us with some insight on what it's like to run a promotion that has involvement of blood matches, It's our old friend Ron Fuller, who's coming riding in from the North 40 there, Barry, on Lightning. And now let's go to our conversation with Ron Fuller, the Tennessee stud. So, Barry, I'm looking. Yeah, there it is out in the distance. I can see him. It's Lightning coming in. And look who's on board. It's the Tennessee stud, Ron Fuller. Ron, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome, guys. My pleasure.
I hope Lightning's not all lathered up and stuff.
No. He's just getting ready to run.
I mean, there you go.
He's so, ready to go.
So as we've been talking before we started with you, Ron, is we've been talking about blood in matches. When is it too much? When is it, appropriate? And as a man that ran his own promotion for so many years successfully, we wanted to get some of your feelings on this. So let's start at the very beginning. Of course, your father, the legendary Buddy Fuller, had a series of matches with Mario Galento that were hard way. You know, that's a whole different kettle of fish right there, Ron. So tell us about how those matches affected your dad and, you know, the impact they had on the promotion and the territory your dad was working at the time.
Well, you know, they actually did a lot of things to prepare for that. They did two of these that I can remember. Both of those crowds, one in Mobile, close to 40,000 people. The second in Atlanta and Ponce de Leon, somewhere in the 30,000s was estimated. I don't know what they actually came up with a final figure or not on that. But both of those crowds were monstrous. And they worked the angles prior to the Mobile show for about 2 months, basically, with between Dad and Galento, in which Dad had always been just a promoter there. He did not wrestle for the first 2 years that he started that promotion on the Gulf Coast in Mobile, Alabama. So Galento had a really good point when he got after Dad about the fact that how come you don't have the guts to get in the ring? You're supposed to be a wrestler. We hear that you've wrestled everywhere else, but this is your territory and your company. And why is it that you don't have the guts to get in the ring to wrestle? So they played this back and forth for a few weeks, and then they actually got into a fight. They Dad set it up to where they ran into each other in a restaurant in downtown Mobile and got into a fight in that restaurant. The fight started in a restaurant, went out into the street. The police came, and the police recognized them. The police stood back. They didn't try to break it up. And Dad was happy with that. He wanted it to kind of end that way. They actually busted each other a hard way in this fight in front of the restaurant. And Galento had parked his Cadillac. He had a Cadillac. He had parked his Cadillac out in front of the restaurant. And Dad grabbed him by the back of the hair, and he had that long black hair, and he slammed his face into his own Cadillac, into Galento's Cadillac, into the hood. And Dad said, you know, they were shooting. They wanted it to be real. The cops believed it was real. They're standing there watching it. And he said when he slammed his face in the Cadillac, it actually dented the hood of the Cadillac. So it brushed his eye. That was one of the hard ways that happened during that fight. So anyway, they took that and they took him to jail, arrested him. They did the whole deal. They went through the court proceedings, went through the whole deal. And then they booked them in this big event in Ladd Stadium in Mobile, Alabama. This match, I think Dad told me later, years later, he didn't talk to me. I'm at this time about, I'm in the second grade, so I'm seven, 8 years old. And I didn't get to go to the match. It was so violent. I asked him years later, I said, how long did the match last? He said, it was about 7 minutes. And I said, how did y'all do that? You know, I mean, I don't know if y'all have ever seen the picture of Mario Galento after this match.
Oh, yeah, with a swollen face, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. 32 stitches in one eye, 7 cuts in one eye. Busted him 7 times in one eye, Dad did. And he broke Dad's nose in the deal, hit him in the nose rather than the eye. And it was a brutal, brutal event. It was long enough that it lasted 7 minutes, and they didn't have a finish. And I asked Dad, I said, well, what did you do? Was every punch a hard way? And he says, no, it was one working punch and then a hard way punch. And so it was so brutal that the athletic commissioner came and threw the towel in and stopped the match. They would have probably gone longer. He said that they were going to go until they were unconscious. And I can believe that, knowing Dad. So that was kind of my first experience at seeing Hardway. He had busted Dad's eye one place, but Dad busted him all over his forehead and both eyes. Both of them had black eyes. My father's eyes were so swollen that for 2 weeks he could not drive a car or he couldn't leave the house by himself. My mom would take him wherever he needed to go. His eyes were swollen shut. He couldn't hardly see. And I remember after about 2 weeks looking at those eyes being black and full of blood, he went over to a mirror and he took his fingers and opened up the eyelids so he could see what it looked like inside, I assume, and blood shot out of his eye onto the mirror. It was brutal. It was brutal type of deal. And that's what they did in order to get that huge house. And then they did that match, the same match. That was in 1958, Mobile, Alabama. They did the same match in 1965 in Atlanta, Georgia. The only difference being in that match in Mobile, the referee was Joe Louis. In the match in Atlanta, it was Rocky Marciano. So, what he did is he drew in those boxing champions who were big at that time to be able to fill those big, huge stadiums. And he did do it. So that's basically kind of what happened in those two matches. Second match, Dad was the only one. I think Mario was bleeding, as I remember. Now, I'm a lot older at that point. I'm actually watching that one from up top of the stadium. And I know that Mario was bleeding some, but Dad was bleeding very, very badly. Dad won the match. They have a picture. I have a copy of it on my website in my gallery. Of Paul Jones on one side of him and Rocky Marciano on the other. Dad has the championship belt in his hand, but you can see by the picture that he's concussed. He has a concussion. His eyes aren't looking. They're looking at the camera, but he's not there. Lights on, but he's not there. I mean, they have just beat and battered and half knocked their heads off. And that comes back to haunt you someday. My dad died with Alzheimer's. My grandfather died with Alzheimer's. I have no idea how many hard ways Roy probably did, but I know my dad did bunches of them. And word was from wrestlers that he hard weighed, he actually hit, that he was the best in the world at it, that he could really bust somebody easily. And I saw him do it many, many times. And he even wanted to show me once, and I said, no, you're not going to bust my eye.
That's okay.
I said, you're going a little far here, Dad. No, I don't think I need to have a busted eye to figure out how to do it. You know, I never busted anybody's eye, but that was the thing back in the 50s. And prior to the 50s, wasn't much use of blades at that point. In fact, my dad ran the territory in Gulf Coast, and he actually told his wrestlers that he would pay them $25 for each hard way they did every week. And I asked him, I said, well, how much money did you pay? And he said, well, you know, and most guys would maybe do it once, and I would pay them $25. And I was curious about Galento because he was such a far out there dude. I said, how about Galento? And he said, 150 usually a week. He would bust his eye 6 nights a week or his face 6 nights a week. Wow. He said it was just unbelievable what Galento was capable of doing. And then go in some instances that I heard stories where guys went with him to get sewn up. And one doctor said, you know, let me get the anesthetic and let me get the stuff ready for you so that it won't hurt so much. And Galento said, oh, hell with that. Just sew it up. He didn't care. He didn't even have to have the stuff that's going to.
So when, Ron, I don't mean to interrupt. I'm sorry. When does that transition from hard way being what a promoter wanted to where, you know, whether it's in the northern part of the country or in the south, where, of course, you and your family are predominantly at, when does that transition into people starting to use the blade?
I think it probably starts somewhere in that time frame, in the late 50s, I really truly believe. And Dad did it because his theory was that the hard way is not just the fact that you're going to bleed during the match, but it's what you look like the day or after the match and a week after the match. And in some cases, like in his and Galento's case, 2 or 3 weeks after the match.
Yeah. And the people around town can see the results of what happened. Go. Yeah.
You're a walking billboard. That's basically what you are. You're a walking billboard. And everybody that sees you, they know who you are. And they go, wow, that was real. And it was real. So, you know, there's no denying it. So, and I think guys started using the blade because it's easier. It's pretty difficult getting that blow, for instance. You've got to get hit really hard to bust your eye. But if you know how to do it, and Dad knew right where to hit, it's really easy to do. But if a guy doesn't know where to hit you and he's trying to bust your eye, it can be extremely painful. I have had guys try to bust my eye. I wanted to do a hard way in Knoxville as late as 1975. I wanted to have a hard way. I was going to the hospital. I already had a broken collarbone, and I was wrestling with a broken collarbone. I knew I needed to go to the hospital anyway, and I wanted to have a busted eye so that I could be sewn up at the same time. I was just trying to really influence the doctors as much as anybody else. I wanted them to see that, you know, wrestling was real. And I think that started to escape probably or somewhere or change somewhere around the 50s when the blade became a lot easier to do. And it wasn't so called for to have hard ways anymore.
Wow. So, Ron, I'm a loyal listener of the Studcast, and I remember you vividly talking about your cauliflower ear. Did you ever discuss on the Studcast your first time blading?
No, I don't think. Well, I did maybe discuss it because the first time I bladed, I did myself. The second time I bladed, Ronnie Garvin cut me. And it was in Fort Myers, Florida. We were both wearing masks. We had worked a long 6-month program, Loser Leave Town. He came back as Mr. Fort Myers, and I came back as Mr. So-and-so, whatever. We had both lost matches. We had both come back and wearing masks. And we were going to both go an hour that night and then blade each other. I'd never cut through a mask before. I had only cut myself once, period. So I told Ronnie, you do it. And Ronnie cut himself. And then my mask was thin. He had a real thick mask on, and my mask was much thinner. When he cut me, he hit an artery. And it started, well, it bled, as you can imagine. I mean, it was, he did it. I lowered my face toward the mat, and it just shot out of one side of one eye hole of that mask. It was probably a foot across instantly. And it bled so bad that I couldn't see enough to finish the match with the mask on. I actually pulled my own mask off. And I was bleeding so bad that I fell down a couple, and I would be facing the crowd. I would take these bumps and be holding the ropes on my knees or whatever, and I'm selling, obviously. I'm bleeding like crazy. And I was shooting blood 3 rows back in ringside from the artery that was cutting my head. It looked like a sprinkler, except it's red. And I remember about after 3 minutes or 4 minutes of that, Les Thatcher came from the dressing room, and he tried to stop the match. He pushed me into the corner, and he pinned me in there. And I was bleeding all over him, too. And he said, hey, you're bleeding to death, you idiot. And I said, it's going great, Les. Well, we got him. Get out of the way. You know, I was just so gung-ho. I wanted to just keep it going. And he was like, you got to get out of here. We got to get you to the hospital. And I remember looking at the ringsiders, and there was nobody in the first 3 rows of ringside except one guy and a girl that was with him. And I remember taking a bump intentionally. I said, man, I'm going to get them all. I'm going to run them all out of here. And when I took that bump up, I'm leaning over the ropes and that blood shooting straight out. And I just aimed at them. I just moved my head enough and the blood went right across her white dress. She was wearing a white dress and it went just a glob of it, man. And here they got up and left. I was like, well, I'm going to go to the dressing room. I guess that's enough.
Well, I would say, Ron, that if you, had Ronnie Garvin do that, there certainly has to be a trust factor where you're basically giving him, you know, you talk about wrestling is giving your opponent your body. Well, in this case, you're giving him your head, and there's got to be a real trust factor. But you said that you had the first time you had done it yourself. So was it your father that showed you the way to go on that, or was it somebody else in the dressing room?
Oh, somebody else. Now, my dad would never show me how to blade. I don't know that my dad used blades. You know, most of the time, I think he let people hardway him when he was going to get busted. And he didn't like the use of the blade because he was always afraid that people would see it. You know, with a hardway, they see it, but it's real, you know. Sure. So there's nothing there that isn't real. But that blade is a little more difficult. So, yeah, I had other guys that showed me how to do it. I usually, after that experience with Ronnie, I started doing myself naturally. And I don't think I used to let Don Carson, who was very good at it, do me in Southeastern in Knoxville in the 75-76 time frame. And he was so good at it, I'd just let him do it. But other guys, no, I really didn't trust a lot of people to use that blade on me.
So where, if you don't mind me asking, you know, famously Ric Flair keeps them in his taped in his fingers. I've heard of other guys that kept them in their mouth. Where did you hide the gimmick?
In my mouth.
Oh, really? Okay.
In my mouth. I would put it in the back of my jaw. Where your big teeth are back there, between the side of my gum and my cheek. And I always felt fairly comfortable when I first tried it. I kept thinking, gosh, man, I hope I don't swallow this or, you know, something. But I never did have a problem with it. But, yeah, and everybody had their own way of doing it. They had their own way of making their blade. They had their own way of taping it to their fingers or wherever they were going to use it. Everybody had their own style of doing it. And I never really felt comfortable with it. And I think a lot of that was because of my influence from my father, who just didn't like it, you know. And I used a bunch of them, obviously, and my brother was excellent at it. My brother always got great blood, and some guys, I had a harder time. I think I felt sorry for myself. I didn't really want to do it. You know, my brother, he didn't care. Bang, it was always there, and some guys were better at it than others. And some guys were sure much better at hiding it than others. I have seen some guys that were just, oh, I wanted to go, oh my God, that's horrible. You know? So that was the downfall. And the bad part about it is you work your ass off to get your wrestlers over and to get an angle working and everybody getting into it. And boy, you didn't want to destroy it or destroy your business by somebody just doing something that right in front of everybody's eyes. And I have seen that happen.
Wow. So you mentioned we were talking about Mario Galento, and there was a match, I believe it was in 1969, and there was a hellacious feud. Mario Galento was actually the babyface. This happened in Florida, and he was wrestling against J.C. Dykes. And I believe it was a brass knuckles match. And J.C. Dykes, at the end of this match, it looks like somebody had just taped him and dipped him into a pool of blood. And I've got the photos. Unfortunately, they're black and white photos, so it's not going to have the same kind of impact. But you were in a territory in Knoxville with a guy who's considered probably one of the great bladers of all time. And I don't know if blade's even the accurate term, because Ron Wright had something that was called the chisel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's not blading. Believe me, when you see that tool, it's a whole new ball game. First time I ever met Ron Wright was in Florida in 1971, and he came through and stayed 2 weeks, I think it was. And he brought his chisel. That's what he called it, was his chisel. He had that old in a Tennessee accent, my chisel. I'm going to get me somebody down here in Florida with my chisel. And he sat in the dressing room, and it's a little piece of metal about 2 inches wide and all the way across the palm of the back of your hand, and you just slide it on your hand. And on top of that metal, he had a little triangular-shaped piece of metal that stuck up about at least a half an inch high. And it kind of, obviously, since it's triangular-shaped, it's thicker at the bottom than it was at the top. And he would just basically hit you with that. And it would cut you. Oh, it cut you deep. And you would, oh, blood was just amazing from using the chisel. And nobody had ever seen it in Florida. And he came in and he took it out and he had a little file with it. And he started filing his chisel. And we all sat looking at each other and like, what the hell is he doing? And I think somebody finally went over and said, what are you doing, man? And he goes, that's my chisel, you know? He goes, well, what do you do with that? And he goes, I put it on my hand, and I'm going to get some juice on somebody. I was like, God. Well, we all were. We were all appalled. They're like, oh, my God, man, is he for real? And then he said, on his first night there, he says, I'm going to be here 2 weeks, and I guarantee you I'm going to hit somebody with my chisel before I go. And his last night there was a battle royal in Lakeland, Florida, and he got a guy named I can't remember. It was a young guy that had been Joe Flaherty. He had worked there for a while, a young guy. I don't think he ever became a star of any kind. But he tied Joe Flaherty in the ropes in the middle of a battle royal, and he pulled out his chisel and put it on. We all backed off. I mean, like the battle royal was over. I mean, we all just backed off like, oh, hell, my gosh, what is this? And old Flaherty's kicking and fighting because he sees him coming, and he's been watching that chisel get filed all week long like the rest of us. And he popped him, and, man, I'm telling you, instantly he's bloody all the way down to his waist. You can't see any skin but red. And that was a pretty horrifying tool, that chisel.
So, Ron, let me ask you, let me have you put your promoter's hat on now for the next couple of questions that I have for you. So, you know, there was an old adage that said red makes green. So you're the promoter in a territory. How is it you determine when to use blood and when not to? When is it too much? When is it, like, I don't know, not enough? Do you prefer to use it in a match, in an angle? How are you as a promoter approaching the use of blood in your territory?
You didn't want to have blood every night. I mean, if you do it every night, it means nothing. So, you know, you want to have it every once in a while. You don't want to have blood in two matches or three matches on the same card, or even, you know, more than, say, once a week, you know, as an example. So you kind of pick the hottest angle. You pick where you want to go. I mean, hey, these guys are really into it. It's going to make sense. Let's do it tonight. Sometimes you do the double blood. I mean, and that makes it even more effective. And it usually jumped your crowds. I mean, it certainly translated into dollars. That's for darn sure. But
when you used it on a more limited basis. And as you said, not like, you know, because if you see it every single match or every single night, it stops losing its meaning.
Yeah. Yeah. It's meaningless. After a while, people go, well, you know, I expect him to bleed. It means nothing at that point. Now, you don't want to do that. It's important because the sport is wrestling, and you start out two guys. The greatest program starts with two wrestlers that just really basically wrestling, and then they have a problem, and then it escalates, and it gets a little worse, and every time they wrestle, it's a little more violent, and then finally, there's a time for it. It's time when it makes sense, and that's when it draws money. It's got to make sense. You don't want to just do it if there's for no reason whatsoever. It's got to start with an angle that builds into a program, and the program becomes so strong, and the emphasis on these two wrestlers becomes so strong that it's time to use the blood. I think there was a was a place for it. There definitely was a place for it. I think it helped to put asses in the seats. And it was part of the business. You did not refuse. I don't ever remember anybody saying, no, I won't do it. I'm sure there were guys that refused to do it. But I don't remember in the South or the play, you know, Australia, Japan, you know, wherever, you know, where they said, no, I'm not going to do it. And hell, if you look at Japan as an example, Brody and Hanson, you know, take those guys. I mean, you know, you're going to get a lot of that there. They were doing quite a bit of that there. And, you know, I was there and I did it. They wanted it. I did it. I mean, it was part of the business to do it.
Yeah, and it was interesting, too. I reached out to Masa Hori, who is the Japanese super fan, and I asked him about the origins of blading in Japan, and he said it began in 1962 with Ricky Dozan and what was the other guy's name? But it was Ricky Dozan that essentially brought blading over there. And there was a match. I believe Freddie Blassie was involved. And apparently six people that saw this match because of all of the blood, and it was the first time they had ever seen blood in a wrestling match in Japan, six people apparently died of heart attacks, which I guess is what the legend is, which is really interesting. So, Ron, in all of your travels, too, and it was interesting because I just posted a photo of you wrestling Abdullah the Butcher in West Palm Beach the other day. Who do you think used blood? And when I say blood, it can be the blade, it can be the chisel, it can be hard way, but who used it most effectively? Because obviously guys like Abdullah and the Sheik and even Dusty, you know, used it almost every match. There was such a regularity to it that, you know, as I was telling Jeff before we started recording with you, every Wednesday night in the mid to late 70s, you knew Dusty was going to bleed. There was no surprise. But who was the most effective bleeder, in your opinion?
You mean someone that did it more often or got the most blood?
I think somebody that got the most out of it, and when I say that, maybe the most crowd reaction. And I'll give you an example, too, and I can't say because I wasn't there, but I was at the WFIA convention in 1978, and it was a great experience. And we saw a Russian chain match between Ronnie Garvin and the Great Malenko. And if you saw a gimmick match like that, whether it's a Texas bull rope match or a steel cage match or a Russian chain match, you do expect blood. That being said, Ronnie Garvin hit a gusher. And I mean, he was bleeding everywhere. And because I wasn't familiar with your territory, you know, first time ever seeing it live, I walked away and I was just, that was a holy shit moment. I mean, you know, Ronnie Garvin really left an impact. So who, in your opinion, of everybody you worked with, and maybe there were guys that you didn't expect were going to be blading. You know, you mentioned about people refusing to blade. And I think Jack Briscoe, I believe he bladed once or somebody bladed him and then he said, never again. And I got to be honest, you know, I grew up watching Jack Briscoe. I can't remember Jack ever bleeding in a match.
Yeah.
So he may have refused.
You're right about that. Jack didn't like it. Yeah. I remember my father one time when Jack was really hot, wanted Jack to hard way a guy on television because they had some kind of bounty deal going and they were sending in these bounty hunters after Jack. And Dad said, we want you to bust this guy hard way. And Jack says, no, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. Well, Eddie and Dad really harped on it. I was there in the dressing room and heard the conversation. And Jack kept saying, no, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. And they said, oh, you need it. We need it. We need to bust him a hard way. We want it to be real. We want to show him next week on TV, the whole deal. And Jack tried to bust him, and I remember he couldn't bust him. And I watched Jack. It was really difficult because I really admired Jack, and I really Jack helped me a lot as a young guy, as getting started. And I felt sorry for Jack because, you know, he didn't want to do it to begin with, and then he couldn't do it. He hit the guy. The guy really went for it. The guy just kept coming back. Again, it was a Mexican kid, and I don't remember his name, but, well, Jack just banged him, maybe at least four or five times.
This was in Florida, right?
This was in Florida. This was on TV. In fact, it was an TV match.
That was, if I'm correct, I think his name was Gil Rivera.
There you go. Could have been.
He was brought in as I believe he was a bounty hunter. And I have, Jeff, if you remind me too, I can get this up in our Facebook group. I have photos that made the front cover of the weekly wrestling program of this guy, and his face is all caved in. He's beat up. Yeah. I never knew the backstory. There it is.
There it is. I mean, he could not bust him because he did not hit him. It's all based upon that eye, just above your eye, that eyelid bone there is very sharp. If you run your fingers along the edge of it, you can feel that bone in there. It has a little bit of a triangular shape to it. And if you put that knuckle right on that spot right there, it's going to cut easily through that eyebrow above your eye. And that's where they were trying to get Jack to hit him, and Jack couldn't hit him in the right place. And the guy had a lot of guts. I felt sorry for the guy too. I thought he would get out of the ring and go to the dressing room, but he stayed there, and Jack probably hit him four or five times. I knew he was going to be really nasty looking, swell up and look brutally bad, but they wanted the blood too. They wanted that blood factor too. And I think that Eddie and Dad might have been a little disappointed with the outcome of that. I know Jack despised that match, and I'm sure the Mexican boy didn't care much for it either.
Well, Ron, on behalf of all the listeners here for Breaking Kayfabe with Wouter and Barry and yourself, once again, Barry Rose coming out with a name out of the hat, Gil Rivera. It's a long way to stump Barry on CWF trivia there, Ron.
Yeah, that is. I mean, that's pretty amazing. And I believe he was a Mexican boy. I know it was
he was
coming in as a bounty guy. And Dad and Eddie said, hey, Jack, this is what we want to do on TV today. We want to stop the bounties. We want to make a point here. And it was an experience for me as a young guy to hear that conversation, to go out there and watch what happened, and to feel sorry for practically everybody that was involved, to be honest with you.
So let me ask you, Ron, getting back to your time as a promoter now, one of the things on the Studcast that you've talked about recently is your move to the new station and all the great help you were getting, production-wise, from the people that worked at that station. But you were talking recently about when you ran your first angle on the station and the impact it had. So let me ask you, when you're doing a hot angle that involves a lot of blood, how do the people at the TV station react? Are they objecting to that? Are they okay with it because they know maybe it's going to increase ratings? What was your experience along those lines?
Well, you know, when you're dealing with television people, they're in the television business and they're not in the wrestling business. They don't like blood particularly. I found that they didn't like blood. I really never had very many people complain about it. When I had my last wrestling company, USA Wrestling, in 1988, back in Knoxville, Gordon Sully doing the program, we're doing it in a big studio, and I had a young kid named Todd Morton get blood for the Stomper, Mongolian Stomper. And it was one of those that he hit an artery, and it was extreme blood, really so extreme that the television station went back, and once he started bleeding, they put that little fuzzy looking face over his face. They didn't show the blood. And that was my first experience with being with a television station that did not want to carry that, you know, and it was a lot of blood. It was extreme blood in that particular match. And then you can have that. But it's you know, the stations don't like it. I don't think they really liked it. But they loved the numbers, by golly. And that's what they had you on there for. You were producing them those big numbers. And they're selling those commercials for a lot of money.
Yeah, I got to tell you, too, Ron, I absolutely love the Studcast. I listen every week, and I listened to this past week, and you were it was great stories talking about Ricky Gibson and your cousin Jimmy Golden, and we saw them in Florida in 1975. They came in as a tag team, and they didn't get a huge push, but they were over with the fans, and they left an impression on me. So I've actually gone in and I've cataloged and documented their ring record as a team in 1975. But the reason I bring that up, and I encourage everybody to check out our Arcadian Vanguard brother, Ron Fuller, in the Studcast every week. It's besides our podcast, Ron, it's my favorite podcast. Don't tell anybody.
Wait a minute.
It is my favorite.
Thank you very much.
I'm breaking kayfabe on that, absolutely. But so Ricky Gibson, and the late Ricky Gibson, was a hell of a worker, but he was known for hitting the blade. And he was, if I'm correct, Jeff, wasn't he in the original Tupelo concession stand brawl?
I think Ricky and Robert may have been in the as a tag team in the original Tupelo concession brawl.
So Ricky was a very, very good worker, but there are a couple of matches that are out there. I know there's photos too, but he's a guy that apparently did like the blade as well, because he is just absolutely covered in blood, similar to what we saw from Tommy Rich. Tommy Rich in, I guess it was the 1990s, was working a lot of high schools in Georgia, and they released a video, and it was called The Bloodiest Battles of the South. And it was very odd, because you'd have Tommy Rich wrestling these guys. He would just hit the blade really hard. He's covered in blood all the way down his legs from head to toe, and he's stumbling around high school gymnasiums in front of little kids. So it looks really odd to see it. But Ron, do you think that we'll ever see the blade come back in a major promotion? And when I say that, I don't mean like a very small outlaw promotion that relies on blood and gimmick matches and things like that, but where blood will be used to really make a point. And Jeff and I both agree with you. Jeff and I have discussed this. Blood is, to me, it's an exclamation point. It needs to have an impact on you, and doesn't need to be used in every match. And you know, it's used to the point of overkill. But it was recently used in AEW, which is the new promotion, and it was a match between the two sons of Dusty Rhodes, Cody and Dustin, and it was very impactful. As I watched it, you know, again, it was a holy shit moment for me. I sat there, and it was very impactful. Do you think that we'll ever see blood on a fairly regular basis in a mainstream promotion? And I guess mainstream being somebody that has a TV outlet.
I don't think so. And I don't think it's because of the promotions feeling about it. I think it's more based upon these major networks and these major cable affiliates. I don't see them letting you go there anymore. I think it's a very violent thing. And as you said, it's impactful. And as long as you don't see it too much. And that's probably one of the reasons that it is more impactful today, because it has kind of stopped being done in a lot of places, and they just don't do it a lot anymore. And that's going to always lead to a greater impact. I'll tell you real quickly here, guys, Australia, 1973. I'm working there, and the Aussies are just doing jobs. It's been that way since Barnett started there. And my dad's involved with him in 73. I'm in that crew, and I hear them talking to George Barnes, who is an Australian. And they tell him, George, we want Dad. Dad had an idea. He said, let's quit taking the Australians and just beating them to pieces. This is their country. Let's take an Aussie, pick one, and let's make a star out of him. And in order to do that, let's bust him a hard way on TV and let everybody see that blood, and let him do a good interview, and let's turn this thing around in Australia. And they did it with a guy named Greg Peterson, little small guy, used to be a great worker back in the 60s. And Greg Peterson's very good at busting guys hard way. And he hit George Barnes, busted him hard way on television in Australia. And I will never forget it. He beat Peterson in the middle of the ring. First time that an Aussie had ever probably won a match in the history of Australia. And it was a moment in that country. And he went to that microphone and grabbed it. And then that Aussie accent said, "My God, you know, they'll never beat an Aussie again. They'll never stop me now." You know, and he did a phenomenal interview. It lit up. I got a feeling in watching that country, every place that show went, those Aussies are going to stand up in their homes and go, "Yes, yes." You know, and it really, really had an impact. That blood and that hard way had a tremendous impact on wrestling in Australia.
Okay, well, Ron, as we're starting to wrap up here, and let me just tell you how much we appreciate you taking some time out of your day to do this. This is really great stuff. So the obvious question as we wrap up is, so tell me, not you yourself, but as a promoter, as a guy working on a card, what's the bloodiest match you've ever seen or that you remember seeing?
Oh, geez, I have seen some really, really bloody matches. You know, as you said, Tommy Rich was always great. Tommy always got a whole lot of blood. Ricky Gibson really got a lot of blood, too. Gosh, I can't come, you know, I have seen so many of them. I have seen guys bloody down to their shoes. And I was that way myself in Fort Myers when I cut that artery. And there are guys that are just, Abdullah, Abby got lots of juice in his lifetime. My gosh almighty. And not just on him. He liked to do it with others. Worked with Sheik. Sheik was the same thing. Some guys just built their careers around blood. Those guys, obviously, they probably didn't get as much as some of the guys that didn't get blood a lot. I think those that really bled down to their shoes went too far. And I think if you had a chance to talk to them afterwards, said, "Would you have gone that deep if you had known where it was going to go?" They would have probably said, "No, I wish I hadn't have," you know. But it's a hard and difficult part of the business, guys, getting blood. I don't care who you were. Some guys didn't mind it. Dusty got it every night, like he said, and he needed to. He was in the middle of a tremendously hot angle that just roared. It drove Florida business through the roof, and he had all those heels of Gary Hart's to contend with, and he needed it every night, and by golly, he never backed away from it. He gave it to everybody. In fact, he got to where he didn't just blade his head. He'd blade his arms and his shoulders. And, you know, he would just bleed everywhere sometimes. And I had a lot of admiration for Dusty for being able to do that. I don't have any one particular match that really I can, off the top of my head. I have seen my brother bleed to his shoes on many, many occasions. A lot better job than I would ever done in that circumstance and haven't been asked to.
How did Jimmy feel about it?
Jimmy got it too. Yeah. Jimmy was good at it too. I mean, it was a part of the business. Those guys that really had their heart in the business, they did their best. And some of them went a little too far sometimes, I think. I just admired guys that were willing to do it on a regular basis and do it right. It took a lot of heart, and it was part of the business. And I don't know that it'll ever be a part of the business anywhere near like it was 70s, 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Well, listen, once again, on behalf of Barry, Ron, we really appreciate you taking time out of your day. We want to encourage I can't imagine anyone that listens to this show, Barry, that doesn't listen to the Studcast, because that is the go-to place for wrestling history. I'm keeping up. I'm absolutely fascinated by the Knoxville stuff, Ron, and your switch to the new station that you've been talking about over the last, four episodes, and the way it affected the business there in Knoxville. Just really, really stellar stuff. And we do appreciate your time tonight, Ron.
Well, thank you very much, guys. I enjoyed being on, and anytime.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, Barry, as always, Ron Fuller, a absolutely stellar guest. Just so much history there with Ron and his family, and it's always good to talk to the Tennessee Stud.
Yeah, I feel like Ian Totten right now, who's, I know, one of Ron's biggest fans. You get a chance to sit and talk professional wrestling with a guy like Ron Fuller, a guy that literally has seen and done it all, but a guy also whose memory is so intact. It's just that may have been one of my favorite interviews we've ever done. That wasn't even an interview, really, when you stop and think about it, but just a great experience. Really, really enjoyed the time talking with Ron today, Jeff.
Story time with Uncle Ron. That's what we'll call it.
I like it. I think we should do it. I like it.
There we go. So, you know, Barry, before we got to talking to Ron, put a list out of matches that I remember, a couple of angles that involved a lot of blood. We did not ask Lord Barents. Tell us your remembrances of matches that involved a lot of, I'm having a feeling one might involve the Missouri Mauler.
Yeah, exactly, Jeff. So, and if you know me, then absolutely. So, we talked about this, and then I think you even posted photos in our Facebook group. And our Facebook group, by the way, Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry. It's a great Facebook group. It's very off the wall. It's an extension of this program. I fully encourage you. Jeff, how many members are we at now?
1,400 plus.
14 plus, but our numbers for this podcast are much stronger. So where are you people? Why are you not joining this Facebook group?
We're getting David Penzer-like numbers. I believe last week it was 6 million, 7 million.
1 million. Go figure. We're up to 1 million this week, Jeff. It's amazing.
That interview with the Disco Inferno never gets old, Barry.
Yeah, sure it does. You know what? After halfway through, it's old. So that's how I feel. Not a fan, but yeah, but with that being said, too, I fully encourage you. But you posted those photos of the Missouri Mauler. So I have a couple of matches. They both involved Dusty, which, you know, obviously was because he did bleed in every match every single week. But the one against the Missouri Mauler was a taped fist match, and that was the match where the combatants would tape their fists and they would come out and they would often go in rounds. So they would often go in, with 3-minute rounds, five, I forget what it was. But Mahler must have hit an artery here, and the blood, his entire face, his entire chest, and he was a big barrel-chested guy. He's covered in blood, and it was really, as a kid, I think I was 12 when that match took place. It was just, you know, unbelievable because it was so bloody and so violent. And again, we had seen a lot of blood, but this was at a different level. The next one was kind of a surprise. And this took place probably a year later, 1977. And Jeff, I do believe I told you this story off the air, but 1977 was also the year, Jeff, I believe it snowed in South Florida, but all the rage for shoe wear were Wallabies. Do you remember Wallabies?
I do not.
You do not?
I do remember I was in sophomore biology class when it snowed in Fort Lauderdale, though.
Yeah. I think you're a couple of years older than me. I'll tell everybody you're at least 10 years older than me, if anybody asks. But I was in, 7th or 8th grade. And I remember it started snowing. And when we say snowing, too, we should clearly say there were flurries in the sky.
the proverbial dusting.
Yeah, if even a dusting. But there was white shit coming down. And that right there, for everybody who had never seen snow before, which was, I think, the majority of all of my schoolmates, we ran out. And it was happening in between classes, and nobody was going back into the classes. So I remember the principal had to get on the loudspeaker. You need to be in your classes, but nobody gave a shit. Everybody wanted to see snow. But I had a brand new pair of Wallabies. And Wallabies were these suede-type shoes. They were brown suede. They were kind of like high-top sneakers, but made out of brown suede might be a nice way. But every kid had them. You wore your bell-bottom jeans, your tie-dyed shirts, and a pair of Wallabies. And it was Wednesday night, And my dad and I stopped at Tom McCann. There's a blast from the past, Jeff. And
absolutely.
On the way to wrestling, as we did every Wednesday, we got pizza. We went to the magazine stand. This week, though, we got a brand new pair of Wallabies because my other ones were just totally fucked up. So we're sitting ringside. The main event was a match between Dusty Rhodes and Buddy Wolf. And I don't remember if it was an Indian strap match or it was a Texas bull rope match. And I'm always, and that is Jeff. Jeff just texted me a picture of a wallaby. Yes, Jeff, that's a wallaby. And I think it was a Texas bull rope match. And it was Buddy Wolf against Dusty Rhodes. And holy shit, was this a bloodbath. And it was primarily Buddy Wolf. And he must have also hit an artery. And there was just blood. It was on it, not only his head and his chest, but both of his arms were covered. And they came out and were fighting ringside. And my brand new Wallabies, 3 hours old, covered in blood. And I sat there and I was just like cursing in my head, not in front of my father and the other ringsiders, but cursing up a storm that my brand new Wallabies now had blood all over them. And this was what I was going to have to wear to school the next day. And
you and Jamie Ward with something in common involving blood on the shoes, my friend.
Yeah. Yeah. But at that stage, Jamie Ward was an adult and conceivably could have gone out and bought himself another pair of shoes. My dad just looked at me, and it's 11 o'clock at night, and he's like, "Yeah, you got to wear those shoes to school tomorrow." And I was like, "Fuck." Right, exactly. So
nowadays, they send a hazmat unit down to your school.
Exactly. I need a note before I can go back, right?
So, Barry, now let's segue to a new topic here on the show. Tell the folks, I know it's been an emotional week in the Rose household as young Zach has gone away to school. It's been a week. How you holding up, Bear?
It's tough. And I'm going to tell you, it's and first, I absolutely have to quantify this. We have people in our group that have lost their children, lost their spouses, their parents. I've lost both my parents. But so I can only imagine. But I got to admit, and I think part of it, you know, as I try to get philosophical and look at it, I was really, really close with Zach. And I had such a hand in raising him when he was a child. My wife was working Monday through Friday in New York, and then I was working weekends or a night. And I took care of him from 7 weeks old, Monday through Friday. There was no babysitter. There was no nanny. It was me and Zach. And he literally, you know, for the next few years, we would watch TV together. We would listen to, you know, AC/DC when he was 2.5 years old. We really had a bond. And everything I did, you know, I always took Zach, whether it was movies or concerts or wrestling, whatever it was Zach. And, you know, he's always been, you know, not only my son, and, you know, again, I had my first child at 37 years old. So I understood the importance of being a parent and having a child, but I absolutely just love this kid to death. And I know all parents love their kids and I get it, but you know, I just absolutely love this kid to death. And, I've been preparing myself, and I've said it for years. I said the two roughest days of my life are going to be when Zach goes off to college and when Ozzy, you know, is barking at the big rainbow in the sky. And I said I would have to go to therapy. Well, I didn't have to go to therapy, but I got to admit it's been really, really difficult. And there are good moments. There are bad moments. Saying goodbye, I'm getting a little choked up, but saying goodbye was really difficult. I cried my eyes out, Jeff. I have no problem telling you. I cried on the car way home. I cried the next day, and I cried today, and it's 6 days later. And, I'm real happy for him. He's doing extremely well. He's having the greatest time, and I take such comfort in knowing that, you know, he's ready for this. And I got to, you know, Tuesday came and my wife and I, you know, we were doing everything we could to not actually leave Pittsburgh. And he kept saying, you know, you guys got to get out of here. Like all the other parents are gone. What are you guys still doing here? And, you know, we just were like, well, we just got to do one thing in your dorm room for you. And he's like, no, no, just give me the extension cord. I got it. And he was absolutely ready. And we do take comfort in that. But at the same time, you know, you raise a child, and I'm not unique in this, obviously, you know, many parents in this group and many people have probably sent their kids off to college. But, you know, the whole time, when I watched him as he walked away, and, you know, and I looked at him, and he's taller, you know, he's over 6 feet at this point. And I just remember, like, I was changing his diapers, and it was just fucking yesterday I was changing his diapers. How does this happen? And, you know, it's been hard. I don't want to tell you it hasn't. I love the kid to death, and I'm just so happy for him. And I know that, you know, this is what every parent goes through when it happens, and I know it's going to get better, but I miss him. I miss him tremendously. And I got to say, you know, after tonight, after we're finished recording, we're doing our first FaceTime call with him almost a week later. Today was his first day of classes. So my wife is anxiously pacing right above me. I'm in the basement, the palatial studios of Breaking Kayfabe with Badger and Barry. She's pacing above me and she's waiting for me to finish so we can go FaceTime our son and see how everything's going for him. But I appreciate you asking. And, you know, it's Pittsburgh, great city, great school. Can't say enough good about it. And if I had my way, every Friday night around 6 o'clock, I'd get in the car and I'd drive up there for the weekend. But we're not going to do that.
Well, I think if there's one thing that anyone knows you does know is that you've done a great job of preparing young Zach for life and for being away from home. Because let's face it, when it comes to the amount of intelligence that young Zach has, we got to credit Mrs. Rose with that because, you know, it's just
and
just
her father. Absolutely. Her father was her father's a certified genius as well. So, it does come from
that. So just as we finish up, I got a quick story that I shared with Barry. Hello, Ozzy. And a quick story that I shared with Barry that I thought was rather funny. So we're coming back from we'd gone up to Atlanta, as Barry mentioned at the beginning of the show, to find a home. Very, very lucky. Looking at like between 12 and 15 homes within a space of about 38 hours. They all kind of start running together, Barry, needless to say. So, but we're flying back. Naturally, we're flying out of Atlanta. There's weather problems. And so there's a delay. Okay. Then after the delay, the pilots were coming in from Tampa. They finally get here. The plane is at the terminal. We're getting ready to pull away from the terminal and head out to the old runway. And now there's another weather situation that apparently is only affecting the airport at the end of the runway. So now there's more waiting. And is there any time in your life where you feel more helpless than when you're stuck on an airplane on the tarmac? You know, you hear some of those horror stories, Barry, of people that are trapped on planes for hours and hours. And I told my wife, I go, oh, my God, I would completely lose my mind. So anyway, we're there on the plane, and my wife and I, we usually get the aisle seats. We're sitting across from one another, and behind us we have two people who are chatting up each other and just yammering incessantly. But I got to listen to this little gem because I wasn't eavesdropping. I couldn't help but listening to this conversation. So apparently – there is a gentleman behind my wife, and there's a lady behind me. The lady behind me apparently was from Romania, and the guy behind my wife is gay. And so they were having a conversation, and literally they had just met. I don't know how they get this in-depth on a conversation after just having met one another. But the guy was talking about what it was like growing up being gay, all the conflicts and issues that confronted him, being a young gay man. And so the woman says, well, you know, I, you know, grew up in Romania and I know how oppressed gay people were. So I can only imagine how difficult it must have been for you. And the guy makes a comment to the effect of, yeah, people just don't understand and they don't realize what we went through. The woman then drops this little gem, Barry. She says, oh, I know what you went through. I know what you've gone through. I mean, I saw the movie Philadelphia. Yeah.
When you first told me that story, so I went in and I searched, Jeff, do you know why she said that? Because fucking Growing Pains is still the number one TV show in Romania. That's why.
So anyway. All right, Barry, it's about time for the go home. We do appreciate you listening, folks. Hey, want to mention a quick shout out to Barry. Some new listeners that we might have here in the Fort Lauderdale area, a story I related to you the other night. So hello to those new listeners. I would encourage all of you to go on and leave your reviews positively, we hope, on the old iTunes for the algorithms. We would encourage you to actually subscribe to the podcast so we know that you're out there. So all the way, I would also encourage you, crowbarpress.com, my friend Scott Teal, my book, They Call Me Booker, still available, please. I'm trying to fund a move here, folks. Oh, Barry, one last thing. Let's not forget what's coming next week, my man.
How excited are you for this? These are my favorite episodes, too. I got to say,
Unsolved Mysteries. I said before, Barry, a couple weeks ago, it was part three. This is part four of the Unsolved Mysteries.
Part four already, Jeff. Well, I'm super excited, Jeff. Let me give you a hint as to what my stories are going to be. One is going to involve professional wrestling.
I can't believe
Yes, but there will be no penises involved in that story.
Oh, my. Behalf of everybody. I will tell you what one of my stories is going to be about, and I will give you an early Breaking Kayfabe preview here. You know, Barry, in one of the previous Unsolved Mysteries episode, we discussed the story of Ken McElroy, the guy, Ken Rex McElroy, the guy from Skidmore, Missouri, who was allegedly killed by the entire town. He was the town bully. There was a movie with Brian Dennehy, I think. I believe it was called Bully. And recently on the Sundance Channel, Barry, I told you, there is a episodic program. I think it's six complete episodes. I've seen three or four of them so far, called No One Saw a Thing, where they go back and they look back at the murder, the effect it had on the town before, you know, his bullying had on the town before the murder, what happened afterwards, because the Federales moved into Skidmore trying to figure out who had murdered this guy. And let's just say that the town went silent on everything that happened. And it's a real interesting retrospective. And I will be discussing that and maybe some other things that have happened in Skidmore since then that kind of make you wonder what the fuck is going on in Skidmore, Missouri. That's all I'm going to say, Barry. So I would encourage you to follow me on Twitter at Baldrin Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Our boy Lulu, sweet Lou Kippelman, on the production duties. We are always appreciative of his talents. Until next week. Cue the Robert Stack music. It's Unsolved Mysteries 4 coming up next.